RadioIslam.com.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Ar-Rahmanir rahim. Maliki yawmiddin. Iyyaka na'budu wa iyyaka nasta'in. Ihdinas siratal mustaqim. Siratal ladzina an'amta 'alayhim ghayril maghdubi 'alayhim waladdallin. Amen. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters. We're talking about Dawah and how to bring Muslims in, and now we got to focus on another problem. Comment was made yesterday afternoon that Dawah is more than just handing someone a brochure and walking away. Muslims, our obligation extend to new Muslims beyond the pronouncement or leading them through the pronouncement of Shahada. We're going to be addressing the topic of why new Muslims leave Islam, a phenomenon that has taken some of us by surprise to the extent that you really don't see it. And unfortunately, I think that extends from the fact that our contact, or we feel our job is done once, as I stated, once one accepts Shahada. And to lead in the discussion as it relates to this particular point in time, and at this time I asked Brother Elias Ba'al-Yunus to step forward and go forward with the discussion.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والسلام على رسوله الكريم نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونستهديه ونتوكل عليه ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا ونشهد أن لا إله إلا الله ونشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. My brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. The East West University on South Michigan Avenue here in Chicago is owned by, actually it is headed by, a very good brother of ours, Dr. Basullah Khan. And for quite some time we had been discussing as to whether or not it will be a possibility for us if some educational institutions take lead in conducting researches about Islam and Muslims in this country. And so he was kind enough to gather a few resources, and then he asked me to come on a sabbatical leave to Chicago in 1996. So I spent one whole summer and one full fall semester, almost like 7 or 8 months in Chicago. My main objective was basically demographic research, trying to estimate the Muslim population. Our objective was really very modest, just to make an estimation of Muslim population in Chicagoland area. But then we found out that it was possible for us to cover the whole state of Illinois. So it took us nearly about 4 or 5 months or so to make this estimation. So the way we conducted it was that we would, especially in Chicagoland, in these 5 county areas, we would pick Muslim sounding names. Then we will try to contact them and request them, if they agreed, we would request them for subsequent interviews and so on and so forth. Very surprisingly, during these interviews we found that although the head of the household had a Muslim name, but then actually he had reverted back to non-Islam, and this aroused our interest, and we wanted to explore further in this direction. And we were able to find out at least about 150 such individual households which experienced Islam for quite considerable time, but then they reverted back to non-Islam. So as we interviewed them, we were able to find some patterns in this research. As I wrote in my memo here, I do want you brothers to be cautious in making any generalizations from this, because the people whom we interviewed did not constitute a random sample, is one thing. Many of these interviews were conducted on telephone, and therefore we were not able to go deeper or at length into their family conditions and their job situations and their marriage problems and so on and so forth. But then we were able to find out that there were at least about four major groupings of people who were involved in Islam and subsequently went back, gave up Islam. These were ex-convicts who constituted the largest number of people in our sample, almost like 50%. And then there were, the second largest group was that of the ex-wives of ex-Muslim husbands. They were not living with their husbands anymore. They were divorced or they were separated. Many of them also had children. And so the third major group was that of the children. And in the end, the smallest group was that of the people whom you called drifters or transients. And as one of them put it, they were floaters. One of them said that he was born in an Episcopalian family. Then a few years ago he had become a Buddhist. Today he is a Muslim and he doesn't know what he is going to be tomorrow. So Islam actually has had evidently a great deal of impact upon the thinking of these people. How they came to Islam and how they gave up on Islam really are two major questions which we all of us have to, who are engaged in Dawah activity, must be interested in these, in answering these questions. First, ex-convicts. The question as to why do people who are spending time in the prisons become involved in Islam? We don't know when Islam first came to the American prisons. There are quite a few speculations. In late 1960s, I was myself involved with some of the prisons around here in Illinois when I was living in Peoria. At that time, Muslim population was really very, very small. And especially among indigenous Muslims, most of the people who were Muslims, who called themselves Muslims, were the followers of late Elijah Muhammad and some of the people who broke away from him and became accepted Sunni Islam. So probably these were the people who, that is, those who were convicted, they were Muslims already, those who were convicted and went to the prisons, were the ones who introduced Islam in the prison. But then the question, why did Islam spread in prisons all over the country, is really a very interesting question, and I can only have speculations about it. I was speaking to the chairman of the Council of Muslim Chaplains, North America. He, fortunately for me, he lives only about 100 miles away from me. And so I have been able to interview him and saw him many times and spoke to him. According to his estimation, there are nearly about 70,000 Muslim convicts spending time in prisons all over the country, I said. Now, given the fact that there may be something like 30,000 or so large penitentiaries in this country, the Muslim population in these penitentiaries must be quite large. Any group of 7, 8, 10 people or 15 or 20 people, sometimes even like in Auburn, New York, there may be at least about 200 Muslims. Many of them are old-timers. Some of them have been convicted for life, some of them have been convicted for very long sentences, 20, 30 years or so, and they accepted Islam in the prison. Those of you brothers who have been working with the inmates probably know it very well, that the prison life actually is a very tough life. It is a very, very hard life. Not only that, the prisons, the inmates have to live all their lives behind those four walls and have to abide by a certain kind of a routine and insults and downgrading and so on and so forth, you see, attacks on their own self-respect as such, you see, by the prison officials. But they also have to stand the very bad, very harsh, sometimes very inhuman treatment on the part of other inmates. And that is actually the worst part of it. Other people who are in the same predicament as you are, and if they are attacking you, if they are insulting you, and if they are beating you up for no reason, and if you are a weak one, then you would like to get support from wherever you could. And so most prisons in this country do have very, breeding grounds for groupings of people. People try to coalesce together. People start making their own small groups of white supremacists or black nationalists and many, many groups. And one of them is also a group of Islamic, with Islamic titles as such. Well, about 20 years ago when I used to visit prisons in Indiana, I found that there were two major groups of Muslims, one who belonged to the group of Elijah Muhammad, and the other group was the one which subscribed to our Sunni ideology as such, and they did not see eye to eye with one another. They used to have prayers on Fridays, but in different rooms and in different ways. But the reason why people turned toward Islam in the prison was simply because Muslim group provided a much greater security and peace to the prisoners, especially the weak ones, people who could not defend themselves. They really got a great deal of comfort, a great deal of security with fellow Muslims. And these Muslims would be ready to fight for them, would be ready to help them, not only against other inmates, but also against the prison guards and against prison officials as such. And so very soon, people found out in the prisons that if you become a Muslim, then you may have a very secure life, very safe life in the prison as such. Typically, Muslim life in the prison generally revolves around an imam. One person declares himself or is accepted as an imam, because maybe he has a good knowledge of the Quran, better knowledge of the Quran and the Sunnah, maybe even has learned how to speak Arabic and is able to have some contacts outside of the prison, is able to invite people from outside for different kinds of functions, for Eid and so on. So I have myself been invited for Eid functions, Eid al-Adha functions and many other functions in the prisons. And so the imam is almost like a charismatic leader. He interprets the Quran and the Sunnah, and he gives them a picture of Islamic community as such, and they idealize Islam on the basis of what they learned from the life of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the Sahaba as such. And so here they, behind these four walls, they live a life of Islam, or they try to resurrect, they try to reconstruct the life of a pattern of Islam which is mostly reminiscent of the life of the Sahaba, I said, when everybody was helping everybody else, you see, everybody was like a brother to everybody else, and they were surrounded by the kuffar, and there was a little small community which was just trying to survive by helping one another and so on and so forth. So, and this really appeals to most of these people who become Muslims, helping one another, come to each other's help, physically and otherwise, and so on and so forth. And then Islam is also a very clean kind of a religion. No drinking, no drugs, no swearing, no attacking, so on and so forth, you see. And so they do have a kind of a view of Islam as being a very noble religion, as being a very tightly knit community, as being a religion in which you ask other people for help and they will come and help you. And so I remember once a brother who came out of the Auburn prison. By the way, Auburn is the oldest prison in the United States, and it's considered to be the harshest prison in the country. He came out of the prison, and whatever little money he had, he wanted to go to New York City, and he stopped by at some place, and then he looked into the telephone directories for Muslim names. He put his finger on one Muslim name and he called that brother. He was a Pakistani doctor, and so he told him that he just came out of the prison and that he wanted to spend a night somewhere, you see, and so he asked him if he could help him. So that brother invited him to his place for dinner, and he was expecting that then he will be on his way. But no, he actually wanted some more money from him. He wanted to stay there, he wanted to spend a night there. And here starts the problem. Now here is a brother who just came out of the prison, and he is expecting that this Muslim brother will really go out of his way to help him. And this brother doctor, you see, he is thinking that he is an ex-convict, and he doesn't know who he is, what his background is, what he was convicted for, and so on and so forth. How could he really invite him to stay at his own place as such? So he told him that, he could give him some money to go stay in a motel, and gave him some more money, you see, for a bus trip to New York City, and maybe some more money. But this really did not wash with our brother coming from the prison as such. He did not receive a very good impression about this Muslim living in quote-unquote free society as such. And so you will find many, many Muslims who are coming out of the prisons. They're also very shockingly coming out of their cocoon of very ideal Islam. It really does not exist in this very society. And as we know it very well, many, if not most Muslims in this country are not really practicing Islam, and they do not really necessarily have to come up to the standards of the Sahaba anyways, you see. And so a Muslim life is really not quite the same in the free society as it was in the prison. So what to do? We do not have any... Here is a Muslim individual, and he remains an individual among millions of people who do not sympathize with him, who are not really ready to help him, who are not really to give him any security or any job prospects or any marriage or family development, construction or anything like that. And so, on the other hand, there are quite a few government agencies, like there are halfway houses which are ready to help ex-convicts. You see, there are many church organizations which are really ready to help ex-convicts. There are many other non-governmental organizations which are established mainly for this very purpose, that you come out of the prison and here is some place where they find you jobs, they give you counseling, and so on and so forth. So once these people are disappointed with the Muslim community, naturally the only other alternative for them is to go to these non-Muslim organizations. They definitely have an impact upon their thinking. Once disappointed with Islam or the Muslim community as such, and helped by the non-Muslim community, they would adopt some of their practices, liquor for instance, sex for instance, or drugs and all of those things. And so they go back, they are lost to Islam as such. And they do not make any pretense about it, they do not apologize for it. As one of the interviewees in my research told us, brother, no matter what you call yourself, Islam actually does not exist in America. So then I knew that he was actually completely lost for Islam. So those of us who are thinking about, are very active about Islamic dawah in this country, should realize, or probably most of us realize anyways, that dawah actually does not stop, as our brother was saying, does not merely stop at giving literature to the Muslims or talking to them about Islam. You know, actually it has to go beyond that. Even after people have become Muslims, they really have material needs, and they have spiritual needs which have to be fulfilled with the help of other people, with the help of other Muslims. And we don't have any institutionalized activity in this direction. Then the second largest group was that of ex-wives. There are many American women who are married to Muslims. There are many American women who do not necessarily have to change their religion. But in many other cases, they do happen to change their religion, probably because of the insistence of their husbands due to having children, or maybe they are more concerned about the future religiosity of their children as such. And so many of these wives do end up becoming Muslims. Some of them actually are really very, very good. Actually, I know many ex-Christian Muslim wives here in Chicago area who became really good Islamic workers and really good champions of Islam in this country, you see. But then there was this sister who was married to this brother for nearly about 20 years or so. She was a Catholic. She became a Muslim. she gave birth to two children. They grew up, became very, very brilliant students. One went to Harvard, the other went to MIT. But then it just so happened that this brother, her husband, wanted to have another wife. And he told his ex-Catholic wife that in Islam it is quite permissible to have, for him to have another wife, I said. And so she gave him the permission in the beginning, and when he got married, had a second wife, Islamically that is, of course they, he couldn't do that according to the American law. But then here starts the problem, how could he live thinking that his her husband has another wife? And so the difficulties started, and finally she separated from him, got divorced, and started counseling with the Catholic priest. And slowly and gradually she gave up Islam and became a Catholic all over again. You see, there are many other women. One of them was Muslim for only 6 months. And so she's very happy that she really did not have to spend a great deal of time with her husband. So here we have a span of time from, say, 6 months to nearly about 23 years. Many of them remain Muslim for nearly, say, 10 years, 15 years or so. When they remain Muslim for 10 or 15 years or so, then how was it that Islam really did not leave much impact upon their mentality, upon their thinking? Why did they have in the end to go back to non-Islam, simply because they lost their husband? Suppose the husband was dead, then what would they have done? Would they still have gone back to non-Islam as such? Again, the question here is, do we have any social support for these sisters who are Muslims, mainly for reason of being married to Muslim husbands, and are they at risk of going back to non-Islam? If this is so, what can we do about it? This is again a very big challenge for all of us who want to see to it that once you become a Muslim, you must remain a Muslim all your life. Of course, children, the third largest group in our sample, they were born to Muslim parents. They were born to a father who was Muslim by birth. Was not necessarily immigrant. It could, the father could be an immigrant as well as maybe an indigenous Muslim, you see. But then the mother was definitely a one who accepted Islam only after getting married. But you see, when she leaves her husband, children go with their mothers, especially if they are small, especially if they are young. And so when she is not living in Islam, when she is not living Islam, her children are not living Islam either. She is drinking, and she is maybe dating, and she is maybe doing all other un-Islamic things, and so children are able to emulate these new patterns coming to their lives. And sooner or later, they also give up Islam. Even if they had seen their parents, even if they had seen their father especially praying, or maybe even took them to the masajid and so on and so forth. So finally, in our sample, we found very few individuals though, whom you could call drifters or transients. One of them called himself a floater. He said, I was born an Episcopalian, then I became a Buddhist, today I'm a Muslim, I don't know what I'm going to be tomorrow. There is a sizable population of the people around here who like to have a taste of Islam at least once. They may probably remain invisible from our eyes because they are not Muslims for a very long time. But if they become Muslims and if they are with us for a little bit of a time, come to our mosque and try to read about the Quran and the Sunnah and the Islamic tradition and Islamic history and so on and so forth, we do have an opportunity. We have a chance here to increase his Islamicity, to enhance his Islamicity or her Islamicity as such. What they do actually have in mind, we do not know. Why they were Buddhist before or why they were Episcopalian before, the most important thing is that today they are Muslims. If they are Muslims today, then we should be able to capitalize upon that state of mind that he or she has. I personally think that these people are very difficult to catch, because probably their commitment to Islam is not really as high as that of the people coming out of the prisons, or even as high as of the women who married with Muslim men, as such. But you see, we are in not taking care of these ex-Muslims are in a way missing the bus. We are losing a very large number of people. According to our estimation in that research project, we found that out of every 100 people who accept Islam, 75% of them give up on Islam. And this is a very big loss. So no matter how much we gloat that Islam is the fastest growing religion in the United States, Dawah really is not the biggest contributor to it. Probably immigration is still the largest contributor to the growth of Islam. This does not have to be always like this, though. The more we are, the more sensitive we are to the problems of American society, the more concerned we are, the more opportunity we have to communicate with our friends, with the people around here. And if they become more and more interested in Islam, we should not merely try to give them more information about Islam. When they become Muslims, we should also try to help, try to see that their Islamicity will really remain as high as ever.
RadioIslam.com